I'm Brady Cruz. Welcome to our second episode in our special series, Truth Tellers. Today, we're talking to Cliff Mass. Cliff is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington, and he has been speaking simple truths about the left's climate agenda and how much of it does nothing but pad the pockets of special interest groups.
Certain issues have become politicized.
Yeah.
And once they become politicized, facts no longer matter. And that's certainly happened with climate.
So we're happy to have Cliff on the show today and to celebrate him as an important truth teller. For people who are, for whatever reason, not familiar with you, give them a little, a little Cliff Notes on your life.
Well, I'm a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington right now. I've been there for quite a while. Before that, I was at the University of Maryland, and I got my PhD at the UW.
Yeah.
And I got my bachelor's degree in physics at Cornell. I work with Carl Sagan there. So that's probably noteworthy. So that's kind of my history.
Yeah, are you tenured at UW now?
Oh, yeah, I've been tenured for many, many years.
We're safe.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, probably particularly now. I mean, you have been in the news a lot. You've spoken out a lot about things that maybe aren't too popular with Democrats and the political establishment here. So does that give you grief at UW ever?
Well, not directly. Okay. Tenure is protective, yeah. Which is a good thing. But I certainly have had people give me trouble. Mm. In fact, probably the biggest trouble was when some students and some faculty got a message sent around that my blog was racist.
Oh, yeah.
So that happened a few years ago, and that was kind of unpleasant. So that was about as extreme as it's gotten.
Yeah. You're not invited to the UW Christmas parties, maybe?
I used to be. I used to be quite friendly with Anna Mari.
Yeah.
Anyway, she has some issues right now, but yeah. I'm okay because tenure is kind of protective. And plus, I do have this blog and they know I can go public if I need to. So between the two of them, I'm kind of okay.
Yeah. You mentioned Anna Mari. Is that how you say her name? I have been butchering her name. I've always said Anna Marie.
Yeah. Anna Mari Cauchy.
Mari. She's out soon. Do you have what do you want to see for a new UW president?
Well, I'd certainly like to see a president that is a little bit more balanced in terms of, taking sides for certain issues. And I mean, she definitely had a left-leaning, type of orientation.
Yeah.
And a lot of us have been unhappy about what she did with the Hamas situation, the Hamas-Israel situation. So I think, we're looking for someone who's a little bit more moderate, at least politically.
I've heard the rumors, I don't know if you have, that Dow Constantine might be gunning for that job.
I've heard rumors, but who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It seems like the timing is sort of lining up, but I don't know if he'd get it or not. Is that that's the Board of Regents and the governor who decide, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, gotcha. So let's talk about the Donald Trump thing, just since it's the last blog I saw of yours. So Donald Trump's going to be in office soon. They've tried to tie him to this Project 2025 that he said he didn't have anything to do with. And one of the things that is being peddled that he might do is get rid of NOAA. So first of all, do you think he would, and is that a good idea?
I don't think he will get rid of NOAA. Okay. So the first thing I did, which I think a lot of people did not do, was to actually read what Project 2025 said about NOAA.
Mm-hmm.
And they really don't talk about getting rid of NOAA. They talk about commercializing some aspects of NOAA, like some of the weather prediction side, keeping some stuff within NOAA, and maybe becoming a little bit less edgy when it comes to global warming.
Mm.
But it really doesn't call for NOAA to be abolished in any sense. And one of my close friends used to be head of NOAA, and he told me that to get rid of NOAA would be impossible. There's too much legislation that's connected. All kinds of things are connected into NOAA. So I don't think NOAA is going anywhere.
Yeah, in terms of some of the, let's just say that secretly Donald Trump absolutely is going to carry out 2025, are some of those changes in privatization, would they be good changes to NOAA?
I think there could be some good changes because NOAA has some severe problems. I mean, they have fallen behind the rest of the world in weather prediction.
Mm.
The forecasts provided by the Weather Service are not state-of-the-art. And so I've written several papers that are published in the peer-reviewed literature in which I describe what needs to be changed. So NOAA needs improvement. It needs to be amended. So I think that can only be good.
Yeah, so when you say they're falling behind on predictions, is that from a technology standpoint, that the private sector might have better technology?
Well, first, other countries have better global weather prediction, like the European Center, for instance. But it's worse than that. The forecast you get from the Weather Channel or from AccuWeather, or you get on your smartphone that Apple gives you, that's better than the National Weather Service forecast. And I can tell you exactly why, but it is. They are better. So, you know, the Weather Service forecast is not what it should be.
Yeah.
And we're paying a lot of money for it.
So you said you can tell me why?
I can tell you why.
Why is it?
Technical quickly, but you know, one reason is that, you know, they not only start off with some inferior models, their global models inferior, but the way they combine the models, there's all kinds of models being run by a lot of countries, and you can combine them statistically. And that's what the private sector does very well. They use machine learning and other approaches to combine different forecasts to get you know, the best possible forecast. The Weather Service is not very good at this.
Why wouldn't they do that, though, if it's been shown that those other models are more accurate than theirs?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, certainly if I was running the place, they would be. But they're just happy to be second or third best. And, I mean, that's the way these large bureaucracies work. I mean, I think what happened to NOAA is very classic in terms of bureaucracies. I mean, big government bureaucracies, you know, spend a lot of money, but they become less and less capable over time. And that certainly has happened to NOAA.
Yeah, well, I would say it's also happened in Washington State with some of the climate spending and taxes and all of that. Speaking of, you know, transfers, Governor Inslee is going to be gone soon. He's made climate his chief issue for the last 12 years. What impact do you think that has on climate policy in Washington when he's out the door?
Well, you know, it's not well known. I actually tutored him for a while.
Tutored him in what, man?
In climate. When he was a congressman. This is a number of years ago. He wanted to get prepped up on climate. So I get a call, and he shows up at my office. And so, anyway, I gave him the basics, okay, about climate and climate change. So, actually, I used to be really friendly with him. If you look at the first edition of my book, he recommends my book.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea.
So we were quite friendly at first. But then he took the dark turn. And he started hyping and exaggerating it. And I started coming out against it publicly. And let's say he became less friendly after that. So anyway, he went off the deep end when it comes to, you know, looking at the science and what it implies for our region. So there's no doubt about that. And I have also strong opinions about the CCA, the tax, which I was actually a part of the group that was opposing it. Mm-hmm. So when he obviously was pushing it. I don't know whether things are going to change radically. Mm-hmm. And the CCA is in place. The bureaucracies, they enjoy the money to use for all their projects. Yeah. And of course, you know, the Democratic Party controls, you know, the legislature. So I don't expect a rapid change.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Ferguson, climate is not an issue he has messaged on the campaign trail. He was messaged on other things that I don't think are genuine. You know, I don't think he's a public safety candidate by any stretch, but he has really talked about climate quite a bit. So, I mean, I guess I don't see as much. Are there other politicians left in Olympia who you think are really on the sort of Inslee bandwagon on climate issues that might hold the torch?
I don't see anybody as enthusiastic about the issue.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to fade a little bit. But, you know, again, you know, it's in the system now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a while to get it out.
The story about Inslee is hilarious. Can you ballpark what year that was that he came to you for climate advice?
Well, I can find out exactly, but I think it's in the order of 15 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Whenever he was still a congressman at the time, so we could figure that out. I could look at the emails.
Did you get the sense that it was really a genuine curiosity to learn, or more so to be prepped up for political talking points?
He seemed interested, I have to admit. You know, so he was definitely interested. But you know, we talked a few times after that, but we haven't been talking lately.
Yeah, well, I would imagine you've not invited over to have dinner with him and Trudy. You said he took a dark turn. Do you remember at all the moment you realized that he had taken that dark turn, or was sort of veering off of what made sense and what would work?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but when he started ascribing virtually every extreme weather feature to climate change.
Yeah.
I knew things were going bad very, very rapidly.
All right, the new year is upon us. That means you might be making some sort of New Year's resolution. How many of you are planning on making a New Year's resolution to lose weight or get healthy? We particularly feel that pressure after the holidays because, let's be honest, there's a lot of food intake involved in the holidays, and you might be feeling less than ideal, like you put on a few pounds, low on energy. Well, I have something that you can do for yourself today. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team over at Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I lost 30 pounds in 2 months on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, and I've been able to keep it off for 2 years through some simple, healthy lifestyle changes. There's no drugs, no injections, no strenuous workout routines. They just teach you what to eat in the right portions and how to take steps to keep the weight off for life. So do what I did, what so many other Undivided viewers and listeners have done. Schedule your free 15-minute consultation with Dr. C today. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. We all know that it's a difficult political environment for landlords, big and small, in Washington state, with new restrictions, new bills, new requirements, new taxes. You need to make sure that you have someone in your corner as a landlord to help you navigate this environment. Become a member of RHA today, the Rental Housing Association of Washington. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. It's about $260 a year. And not only do they advocate for landlords every single year when it comes to policymaking decisions, so you're helping when you become a member with that kind of work, but they're also going to be in your corner as a landlord, help you navigate the legalese, the difficult world of regulations that can vary city to city, county to county, and obviously state to state. So especially if you're a small to mid-sized landlord and you don't want to go it in this political environment on your own, become a member of RHA today. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. Undivided is sponsored in part by Future 42, making Washington a place for all to prosper. If you're frustrated by the results of the last election or frustrated by the direction of what's happening in Washington state, sign up for Future 42's newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to turn that frustration into action and actively get involved in making our communities and our state a better place. Future42.org, Future42.org. So you came out, and I think you were on our show to talk about your support for the initiative to repeal the Climate Commitment Act. It failed dramatically. What do you attribute that to? I mean, even in red areas, they voted for Donald Trump, and then they turned around and voted to keep Governor Inslee's chief climate agenda intact.
Well, I think there's a reason for it, and that is extremely deceptive advertising. First, they outspent, you know, the yes side like 10 or 15 to 1.
They spent like $30 million on it.
And they didn't mention climate. It was fascinating. They almost none of their mass marketing mentions climate. It's all about how the roads are not going to be maintained or some other bad thing. And most of it was untrue. Mm-hmm. But it just shows you have massive amounts of money and you can deceive people. And that's what they did. It's very telling that before they started this mass advertising campaign, actually the initiative was winning.
Yep. Yep.
But then when they started all these mailings and advertising and putting out all these false claims, that's when it turned. And I talked to people about it and they said, "Well, we want our roads fixed."
Yeah.
and they really came away with the impression that the roads would not be fixed if this initiative passed.
Well, and I think it was, so deception, I agree, is a huge part of it. But I also think the confusion, even reading the ballot, doing what I do, it was worded. And the reason I think confusion played a role is of the four initiatives, only one of them didn't have to have that addendum on it that said this is the fiscal impact of it.
Right.
And that was, of course, 2066 to protect natural gas. And that's the only one that passed. So I really think that addendum tipped the scales in a way, and also the wording of it. Because I had people saying, "Hell no, we don't want that climate policy. I voted no." And I'm like, no, you're supposed to vote yes.
Yeah, No, I agree. I think that's there too.
Would you like them to re-up it, try it again?
Oh, I think so. And especially now that the gas prices are escalating quickly,
mm-hmm.
you know, for good or for bad, but the actual, you know, impact on the gas prices was modified downward a little bit before the election mm-hmm. because a lot of people thought it was good. It was going to pass.
Yeah.
But now the gas prices are going, you know, the effects are going up again.
Yeah. The speculators weren't buying
right.
Beforehand. But is there anything in your mind that could, they talked a lot about, you know, the merging of the markets and things they could do, because from here on out, the number of credits available is only going to start to drop.
That's correct.
And so that'll shoot up the price of the ones that are available. So is there anything that can be done short of repeal, which obviously isn't happening, yeah. to try to lessen the impacts, you think?
Well, you're out of my area of expertise,
yeah.
But the price impact will become more and more evident mm-hmm. to people. So what we need to do is try again, but have the advertising budget in our favor.
Yeah, easier said than done, for sure. I want to talk about a few of the things that have come up. You know, you had a blog we discussed on the show about the media and about the Seattle Times. They're very much in line with kind of, I think, Inslee's perspective and his worldview on climate issues. You've been critical of the Seattle Times and their reporting via the Climate Lab. Why?
Well, because a lot of what they publish is simply untrue.
Yeah.
And it's exaggerating and hyping climate change. And I used to be the darling of the Seattle Times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they loved me. They yeah. they spoke to me all the time. They featured me all the time. And it all changed when I took them on about the oysters. This is back in 2012.
Yeah.
They had this huge series, front page series, mm-hmm. about how the oysters were all dying because of CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, it turned out that story was completely false.
Wow.
And I went through the science saying why it was wrong. But they were furious at me. I thought they thought they were going to get a Pulitzer or a prize. And ever since then, they turned on me.
Yeah. You know?
And I had people inside told me, they're not supposed to talk to me. You know, it was right after that. And then they had one story after the other. And I've used my blog to talk about mm-hmm. how it's just not true. I mean, this is before the Climate Lab.
Yeah.
So, I mean, scientifically, just inaccurate.
Well, because that's what I was going to say, is it isn't a matter of a difference of opinion. Some of these things that they're reporting, you're saying, and you've presented them with. Behind the scenes, right? Because the one I'm recalling was about snowpack.
Right. The snowpack was one, but there's just one after the other, like extreme weather events. Mm-hmm. They would hype those.
Yeah.
And so this has been going on before the Climate Lab, but now the Climate Lab folks are in. You know, basically this is paid journalism,
mm-hmm.
and they have one party line.
Yeah. So you've brought, not just on your blog. I mean, you've had conversations with them saying, you should issue a correction. Here's why that's not true, right?
I have talked to them directly. I've left comments there, but they're not interested.
When you talk to them directly, what is the reception like? What do they say?
They say, well, there's other opinions. that's generally the response.
Yeah, alternative facts.
So there are other folks have a different viewpoint. But, you know, I'm giving them facts, and you know, I've studied the weather and climate
yeah.
here more than any other person. I've published, you know, over 100 papers on the weather and climate around here. So I'm just not coming out of, you know, out of the sky. And anyway, they're not interested. Obviously, it's more. I think the Blethams very much have a certain mm-hmm. angle as well.
Yeah, I do believe there's a lot of people around here though who do genuinely care about the climate, and they're worried about it. And they kind of, they eat those things up. And they, you know, it's the Climate Lab and the Seattle Times is saying it must be true. I mean, how do you reach the people who, because I think about it with the homeless crisis, I compare it to that. I know it's like not your area of expertise, but with the homeless crisis, I should think that people who genuinely care about it, right, and the homeless, they should want like every dollar spent on things that actually work. But instead, it's like they're perfectly fine just sort of like talking about how, oh, we need to do this to help the homeless and funding new taxes to help the homeless, and never mind that nothing ever gets better. So I guess you apply that to climate. I mean, how do we reach critical thinkers, people who care about the climate, and let them know that so much of this is just bullshit?
Well, I think it's very much like, you know, the homeless situation. Certain issues have become politicized.
Yeah.
And once they become politicized, facts no longer matter. And that's certainly happened with climate. And the homeless stuff is probably the same thing, and it's probably we can probably think of a half dozen others.
Is there a way out of that place?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've been trying my approach, and that is, you know, getting the facts out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my blog is typically read by 10 or 20,000 a day. Mm-hmm. And when there's big stuff, you know, it can be much more. And so when I had the big events where I'm talking to hundreds of thousands of people, then I often like to get a little bit of a message in there as well. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. What else can one do?
Certainly that has to eclipse the readership of the Times. I cannot imagine their readership is high anymore.
No. Well, in fact, I could go on Google Trends and see how I compare to the Seattle Times.
Yeah.
And so during the big storm days, I'm bigger than they are.
I love that.
And in those days, I use that
to
communicate messages out to large groups.
Well, there was a lot of talk, like the bomb cyclone's a good example. Was the bomb cyclone a climate change issue?
No. Some people were starting to go that way.
They were. Well, that's instant. Any extreme weather event, climate change.
Right. And it just so happens that I did a study on this with the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington, studied this exact feature. And the answer is no, absolutely not. There's no trend to more cyclones. I hate the bomb cyclone. there's not a trend to more intense cyclones. Mm-hmm. They're not becoming more frequent. And climate models don't suggest it. So there's no climate change signal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clear. But some people were going that way.
Yeah.
Okay? And then even the Seattle Times coverage was wrong about that. It wasn't just that there was a cyclone offshore. There was also high pressure inland. And that was crucial because the strong winds weren't over much of western Washington and on the coast. It was on the slopes, on the western side of the Cascades. It was a downslope windstorm.
Hmm.
But that was like, not covered in the Seattle Times.
Yeah.
They didn't bother to get that story right.
Yeah. And I know, I mean, I live in East King County, so it was pretty bad where we were at. And I, you know, the winds were howling. But I also wondered how much of the destruction, the long-term power outages was because this storm really just was that severe versus like our electrical grid that just hasn't been properly weatherproofed.
Well, it's both. I mean, first, it was an unusual event. You know, normally our strongest winds are from the south or southwest. And that's our typical strongest winds. We do occasionally get these easterly windstorms. And this was a particularly strong one. And so you had these winds descending down the Cascades. And they caused a lot of damage. I mean, it was an unusual event. It was a stronger easterly wind event than normal. And the other thing is the lack of management of the vegetation over power lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of power companies, including the one in Seattle here, Seattle City Light, has not been doing vegetation management in a reasonable way.
Seems very in line with like the wildfire situation.
Right. So they could have. I assume they find it cheaper, less expensive to take the damage and fix it, rather than to trim the lines.
Yeah.
And certainly in my neighborhood, you know, we lost our power because there's some trees on Sandpoint Way and the branches were hanging over there. We knew it was a good problem, but they couldn't be bothered to fix it. So the vegetation management is a very important thing. And, you know, this, considering that we want to go completely electrical for everything, right? Electricity supplies all the energy.
Yeah.
We need a more robust system, and we don't have it.
The real estate market has been pretty slow, but that doesn't mean that you can't still get a great price for your home. So if you're thinking about selling your home in 2025, reach out to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Wes and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that your home stands out when it hits the market. He can also help make sure that any cosmetic upgrades to your home are made. He can manage those projects. They can even help you pay for it up front through something called their Listing Boost Concierge Service. So make sure you check that out. Go to their website, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. I have urged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. Why? We all need insurance. Why else? We could all save a little bit of money. So many Undivided viewers and listeners throughout 2024 saved thousands upon thousands of dollars by doing the FirstMark Challenge. What does it entail? Well, you schedule some time with FirstMark, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They'll go over all your current insurance plans with you, talk about your insurance needs, and then they'll go out, they'll shop the market for you, and they'll come back with their recommendations. Undivided viewer Sarah just finished the FirstMark Challenge. She said, we're now saving over $1,100 annually for our auto and home combo. We did end up paying more for earthquake insurance than we are now, but FirstMark told us our earthquake coverage was terrible, so we needed to pay a little more to know that we're properly covered should a quake happen. She said, I'm so glad I finally talked to them. My only complaint is that we should have made this change months ago. And I hear so many stories like that. So don't wait. Take the FirstMark Challenge today. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. Did you notice how the market responded right after the election? Are you happy with how your retirement portfolio is positioned? Is your portfolio actively managed? Well, maybe it's time to get another perspective. It's always smart to get a second opinion when it comes to critical health decisions. Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, feels it's no different when it comes to the health of your retirement portfolio. You can get that second opinion with Bulwark's free Know Your Risk Portfolio Review, where they'll cover the impacts of the election, an outlook for 2025, plus a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. Get a second opinion. Schedule your free portfolio review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com.
The interesting thing about the wind turbines is the power from them went to zero through large periods during the last month. And so what happens is, during some of the most interesting periods, during our coldest weather, during our hottest weather, the wind energy goes to zero.
Why is that?
Because the wind goes to zero.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, basically, when we get really hot periods, we have a high pressure area right over us.
Yeah.
Well, the winds are light underneath those.
Yeah.
When we have a really cold period, the high is right over us, except it's in the winter. And so when we need the energy the most, the wind goes to zero. That's a fatal flaw.
that's the most fatal flaw.
That's a real problem, and of course, our solar is not very useful during much of the years, and certainly during the winter months. The solar energy is just not viable here.
Yeah, well, we know that the state, City of Seattle, King County, the state, environmental groups, they're suing to overturn voters on Initiative 2066. But I mean, even if they wanted to ban natural gas, it doesn't seem like in our lifetimes we'd be prepared for such a change.
Oh, I don't think so. And in what happened, you know, a few weeks ago, it was natural gas was critical in my neighborhood. You know, some people were able to use, you know, gas to heat their homes one way or the other.
Yep.
They have gas fireplaces. Some had generators that could provide enough power to get that furnace going, and so the natural gas was critical to keeping things tolerable for a lot of people. And so I don't think we can walk away from it so quickly.
No, and financially, too. How is anybody going to pay for that? I mean, it costs a lot to electrify your home. When they throw out some of these goals, right, that they have, Governor Inslee loves his goals. Oh, by 2035, by 2050. And the thing I saw from Discovery Institute basically said that none of the governor's goals are even feasible, even within the realm of possibility. And even, are you familiar with the paper I'm referring to?
No.
Okay, I'll have to send it to you. But it was interesting because they kind of went through this assessment of, even if we hit every one of Governor Inslee's climate goals by the deadline, it would only lower global temperatures by 1/3/1,000th of a percentage point or something.
Oh, you're
like
talking
that.
About the the effects globally.
Right.
If we were perfect here.
If we were perfect here, yeah. Negligible, right?
Yeah. Well, to me, I'm not worried about climate change.
Yeah.
Because I think we're going to solve this. Is a solvable problem. Hmm. It's a technical problem. And we have nuclear power right now, which we're not using the way we need to. But in a decade or two, we'll have fusion power. Once we have fusion power, the whole thing's over. The whole problem goes away. And I went to a talk downtown in which we had three CEOs of fusion companies here in the Seattle area. Mm-hmm. There's 23 companies at that time working on fusion. And they said the joke is, you know, we're always 10 years away, but you know, what they said is we're getting close and we're going to get this. Once we have fusion power, we have unlimited power, basically, It doesn't pollute at all, but it's even better than that. Once you have unlimited power, then you can take the carbon dioxide out of the air. We have the technology to do that right now. It's called sequestration, but it takes energy. Well, if you use nuclear power or fusion power, you could pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. Yeah. So we're going to solve this problem. This problem is going to go away one way or the other. And even with that said, it's not that serious a problem. It's so hyped and exaggerated. I mean, the Earth is warming slowly. There's no doubt about that. And mankind is contributing to it. There's no doubt about that either. But it's not the end of the world type of warming. And most of these extremes that they're claiming are connected with it are not. So it's a modest problem.
I have so many questions about that because, first of all, can you explain fusion power to me like I'm 5 years old?
Sure. Well, there's two types of nuclear power. There's fission, where you get an atom and you split it, and energy is released. And we've mastered this since World War II, approximately, right? We have fission reactors. We have one in Washington State that's working, okay, right now. The only trouble with fission power is it produces nuclear waste. France is all. All the electricity comes from fission right now. So it's a technology we have actually mastered. Fusion's different. Fusion is the way the sun works. That's when you can get two atoms and you combine them or fuse them, and then that releases energy. And so that's a technology that right now we've gotten to the break-even point, but we haven't created fusion reactors that can produce massive amounts of energy. But that's going to happen eventually. Once we have that, the energy problem's over.
But is it, though? Because the only reason I ask that, I talk about it all the time with the homeless industrial complex. I'm convinced they won't solve the homeless problem because then all the money goes away. So if you're talking about, like, no big deal, the energy, technology will be there and this won't be a problem anymore, but that means their money goes away. So would they ever let it actually be a solution that gets us out of this place?
They won't have a choice. Technologies, once they've proven themselves to be viable and effective, they take over. If you go back to what was the biggest problem in the United States around the turn of this century, there was horse manure on the roads. That was a real problem. Terrible pollution. Okay, well, and people were coming up with all kinds of plans, all kinds of stuff. Well, what got rid of it? It's the internal combustion engine and cars, right? No more the poop problem went away. So once fusion's developed, there's no stopping it.
There's no stopping it. So you really think you got the, like, people who will be at the time? I'm assuming this is still, what, a decade plus?
I would guess it's probably 10 to 20 years out.
You think that they'll throw up their hands and be like, all right, we don't need all these other programs anymore. Fusion.
It'll be over. It will be over. I mean, their technology, we've seen, look at smartphones, how they took over. I mean, once you have technologies that are really, viable, they win. And this is going to happen here. It's just a matter of time.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, we'll see, right?
In any case, we don't even have to wait. We have fission power now. It works. And that's been pushed aside. We could use fission power now.
That's what I mean, Cliff. You're saying we've got fission power now, but that's pushed aside. And it's like, oh, no. But you're suggesting that if we get fusion and it's all good, and they're just going to, like, accept it and use it, but they're pushing aside.
But fission has the problem of nuclear waste.
Yeah.
Fusion doesn't.
Gotcha.
So I think it's going to be different. There's no way of pushing this one aside.
Yeah. So I want to talk about just the use of climate change as a fear, as a way to scare people. I think Inslee talks about it in that sort of, this is the existential crisis we face, on the planet. He talks about it in these sort of end of day terms. We were just on the show the other day. The Oregon Public School District sent out this questionnaire. It's a health questionnaire for 11th graders. And a couple pages of the questionnaire had to do with climate. And it asked them, how many times a day do you think about climate change? Have your thoughts about climate change impacted your health and happiness? Does it make you scared? Does it make you depressed? I mean, what are we doing to children when it comes to this sort of fear-mongering over the end of days, climate change is going to end the planet thing?
Well, it's not good, but this kind of end of days thing is not new.
Yeah.
I mean, politicians and those trying to gain control for one reason or the other have used fear as a tool you know, forever, right? Yeah. If it wasn't climate change, it was some enemy that was going to do something to you, you know?
Yeah.
So this use of fear as a control mechanism is that's an old story.
Yeah.
And so it's just a new branding. But it's very unethical and it's very wrong.
What, I mean, what do you think the, is there any place for discussions around climate and global warming in our public school district? And what does that look like in a way that is realistic and not about fear?
Well, I mean, the science is relatively clear.
Yeah.
You know, people like myself, you know, have a very good idea of what's happening and what's and what's going to happen, right? So I don't think the science is that debatable, really. We're slowly warming, okay? And, you know, we're causing a significant amount of that warming, okay? And most of the extreme stuff that's being pushed around is not caused by climate change. You know, so you know, the bomb cyclones is one I heard. Another one, cold waves, which is ridiculous.
It's too hot, it's too cold.
The cold waves are caused by climate change, you know. So it's just this ridiculous stuff, and it's very unproductive.
But what should be taught in schools? What should, if you were tasked with teaching a public school course on the climate, what would you teach to kids?
Well, we have to be more fundamental than that. We have to start teaching the students math and basic science.
Yeah.
I mean, I was very active in a group called Where's the Math for a number of years. And in fact, we're coming back together again because the math studies have declined. The students' ability in math has gone.
Oh, yeah, it's failing.
It's gone really bad, really bad. So students are coming out of high school without good understanding of math, science, without ability to have to critically look at information to try to appraise whether it's true or not. So we're very, so that's a crisis. The other thing is a crisis is we're destroying their learning with electronics. I mean, I see this at the University of Washington. It's just a tragedy what's going on with the students there. We have all these remote classes where students can sit at home and don't learn. They come to class and they're playing with their phones the whole time and they're not paying attention. So we're seeing a profound loss of learning and the ability to concentrate in students. This is much more important than climate change, to know the truth.
Well, it seems like, though, for science-based classes, all of this new technology could be really helpful. I mean, it could help you learn in new ways. Is it just sort of being abused then? I mean, it's the issue with, because it does seem like if you're teaching a class about science or the climate, I mean, so much of this new technology. I think of things like, do you ever watch the Weather Channel during major events?
Sure.
And they've got these, maybe unnecessary, but they've got these cool like 3D graphics where they can actually show you, you know, the rise in the water and what will happen and all this stuff. I just feel like technology, especially in science, has a really cool place to play in learning, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. So I think the ability to visualize, the ability to get information, to search for information, to get instantaneously, to do analyses, fairly sophisticated analysis, quite easily.
Yeah.
So these are all positives. But on the other hand, the technologies are being used to undermine the abilities, students' ability to concentrate, to pay attention. They're losing their attention span. So that's bad. So technology is a two-edged sword here.
Well, yeah. As an educator, how do you deal with that then?
Well, I'll tell you how I'm going to be doing well with it. I just finished teaching an introductory class. And the next time I teach it, I'm going to say, you know, no smartphones in this class.
Because what was happening in the one you just taught?
They're just playing with their phones.
You can't just say, put your phone away?
Well, that's what I'm going to be doing.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, this is not high school. This is college. These are adults now.
Yeah.
Right? And so I was hesitant to, you know, treat them like children, saying, you know, you can't learn if you're playing with your smartphone, folks.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm going to have to start doing that. And I think we have to move in that direction.
Yeah, and I guess introduce technology in a more controlled way for a specific purpose in class.
Right, because we're still human beings, and it's very important to have the eye contact.
Yeah.
Because as a teacher, by looking at your eyes, I can tell you whether you're following me. Are you bored?
Yeah.
Am I losing you? Okay.
Yeah.
Should I rephrase something? I need the eye contact to do that. And when somebody's sitting at home, I can't do that. And when they're looking at their phone, I can't do that.
Yeah. Are they still allowing kids to do remote learning at UW?
Yes. In fact, they're pushing it.
And you don't have a choice in the matter.
No.
You can't say you must be here.
In fact, I'm being pressured to do it the other way, to do it remotely, because the courses that have remote learning get more people signing up.
Wow.
Students like that.
Yeah.
So this is a serious problem. This is more serious problem than the climate change stuff, quite frankly.
Well, I'm fascinated by this conversation. You know, climate aside, just as an educator of our future generation in their minds. So you're saying that you don't, as a professor right now at UW, have the ability to require, to mandate in-person attendance?
No. In fact, it's actually encouraged not to.
Wow.
Ever since the COVID, you know, of course, everybody was at home, right? Mm-hmm. Then they came back. Some classes are back in you know, it's all, yeah. all there. Yeah, like some of my smaller majors classes,
yeah.
you know, they have to be there. But the introductory classes, those are, now most of the students are at home.
Yeah.
It's not good.
I worry a lot about this generation for a lot of reasons, but do you get the sense, maybe am I too concerned? Am I too hard on them? I want, you know, kids coming out of high school and out of college to have critical thinking skills. We need it in the country to be able to think for themselves critically, independently, you know, outside whatever their bubble is. Do you see that desire in the students who attend your courses?
Well, you know, there's the golden 10%, and they're as good as they've ever been.
Hmm.
And that's what makes life worth living for faculty like myself. So they're still there. Thank God they're still there. They're the people who are going to run the country. Yeah. We have those. But now there's a bottom end that I never saw before that are really being lost. And they're not getting much of an education. They're staying at home, and they are running into severe problems. So, you know, top 10% is fine, but we have this large bottom end that are not doing well.
And the other ones are just coasting through, or?
And there's some that are just getting by with their, you know, B minus or C's.
Yeah. Well, it's just it's fascinating, kind of this window into all these things happening in society. I mean, just through the whole learn from home thing. That makes sense. I've never heard it explained like, well, they can bring in more money that way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The classes that have that kind of remote capability, these are hybrid classes.
Yeah.
I'm pressured. My chair comes over and tells me, you know, we want more of this.
Wow. Going into the new year, what are your hopes from the new administration on the climate, on the environment? What do you want out of the Trump administration?
Well, I would like them to get serious about making U.S. weather prediction the best in the world. Mm. And a lot of us know exactly how it could be done, but it's going to take changing NOAA, changing the way how we do research and development, and stop wasting so much money. Like, for instance, the United States has 5 different groups doing global weather prediction. It's ridiculous. You know, the Navy does it. The Air Force does it. NASA does it. NOAA does, you know. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing's ridiculous. And we need someone to say, folks, this is very inefficient.
Yeah.
And you're never going to be state of the art when you're dividing all your people and your money up. So we need someone to sit back and say, we got to rethink this.
Well, you need to be in touch with Elon. You need to tell Doge that.
Yeah.
Elon and Vivek. So if Donald Trump came to you and said, hey, will you head NOAA, what would you say?
I'd think about it.
Donald, Elon, Vivek, I think we can make this happen,
you have any connection?
Right?
You have any connection?
Well, I mean,
I know exactly what needs to be
yes.
done if I had the power. But
yeah.
But a friend of mine, Neil Jacobs, was head of NOAA.
Okay.
And he wanted to change things. And he found a few years ago he couldn't do it. He was head of NOAA under Trump.
Yeah.
And he wanted to change things, but the middle management stopped him.
Mm.
The trouble is, you got these high level bureaucrats in these agencies, right?
Yeah.
And they have a lot of power to stop stuff.
Yeah.
And they did. So whoever's head of NOAA next needs to have the power to go down and really change things, restructure in a way that my friend was not given that power.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. I mean, things are. What we're seeing right now form behind this administration is like we've never seen. I mean, this whole idea of Doge, these people he's bringing in who are from all different walks of life. I mean, I feel kind of hopeful about it, that they might be able to make some substantial change. Do you feel, do you even like Donald Trump? Do you like the team he's forming?
You know, I'm hopeful.
Okay.
And the bureaucracy in the country needs to be shook up.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to do, though.
I mean, it's weakening us as a nation. We have this very ineffective large bureaucracy. And I have an intimate knowledge of what I'm in NOAA. I know how bad it is. I know where the problems are. And so, I'm sure other agencies are just like it, right? So I think it's about time to have this kind of conversation. Elon Musk is one of the great American geniuses.
Yeah.
You know, if anybody could do it, it's him, right? He's done it more than once. So I'm hopeful, but it's just a very heavy lift.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to put a cap on it, for what's happening in Washington State, we have a new governor after 12 years. We mentioned, you know, Jay Inslee and his climate agenda is going to, first of all, you think he's going to get a job in the climate sector, right?
I don't know where he's going to
come on. Is there any doubt in your mind? I already made a bet with subscribers.
Okay.
He will have a 7-figure job that benefits from his climate policies in a month.
That's certainly plausible.
100% plausible. So what would if Bob Ferguson did the same thing Jay Inslee did all those years ago and came to you and said, hey, I want to get a grasp on what kind of climate policies I should be pursuing, what would you tell Bob Ferguson?
Well, I would tell him that he should put his efforts into adaptation. Not reducing our emissions, which are minuscule. But what we can do about climate change is we can deal with the problems on the ground. A great example is fix our forests. One of the big areas I'm doing research on now is wildfire meteorology. So I have a pretty intimate knowledge of this subject. And our forests are in terrible shape.
Yeah.
We need to thin them, bring back prescribed burns. The wildfire problem can be solved. But you need a governor that's willing to put the energy and the money into fixing our forests. Strangely, Jay Inslee, for all his talk about wildfires, didn't do it. It was bizarre. Oregon was doing much, much more.
Well, Inslee made it seem like it was this nebulous, the climate is causing this. Like,
and that was but he was wrong about that.
Well, of course he was wrong about it.
He was absolutely wrong about it. I mean, I've read all the papers, so I know he's wrong about it. And basically, we need our forests have been mismanaged now for a number of years, and we have to restore the forests. So that would be number one.
Yeah.
The forest fire problem solved. We can solve that problem. So he could do that. The other thing is adaptation. Snowpack, as we warm up, the snow will get less. Okay? I've written papers over it. Okay? Depending on how much CO2 you put in the atmosphere. So that means we need to store more water. Well, we can do that. Fortunately, climate change will not reduce the amount of water falling out of the sky. It's going to increase it. So we need the storage capabilities. So for places such as on the eastern side of the Cascades, we need more reservoir capacity. And, you know, I've given talks to the folks in Yakima. They're all behind it, right? So we need to have more reservoir capacity to store the water. So we have plenty of water for agriculture, you know, for the rest of the century. That's something we can do. Mm. I can go on and on, but what we need is adaptation efforts. We could do it locally, and it could be extraordinarily positive.
Yeah.
If that's what the governor should do.
Yeah, you mentioned on the wildfire thing in particular, you know, we have a new lands commissioner, much more ideologically to the left than our current lands commissioner, Hillary Franz. Do you have concerns about Dave Upthegrove?
I don't know enough about him to really to comment, but you know, all I can tell you is that whoever is running they only control part of the forests of the state, but they need to work on fixing the forests. Hillary France actually was quite interested in that, and he would do well to follow her lead.
Yeah, it's why the Seattle Times endorsed Jamie Herrera Butler. As they said, as a Republican, she was actually closer to Hillary's approach to forest management than Dave Upthegrove is. So I don't have a lot of faith in that.
You just can't say it's all climate change.
Right.
Yeah. You can't. The mismanagement is much more serious.
Yeah. Well, Cliff Mass, if people want to follow your insights and get a different opinion than the Seattle Times Climate Lab, how can they do that?
Well, I guess just go to my blog. Just search for Cliff Mass weather blog. You'll get there right away. Once in a while, I've podcasted. I was doing it for a while and I stopped. Maybe I'll start it again. So anyway.
Yeah. But,
My blog is the best place.
And then we're going to get you in touch with Doge. We're going to talk to Elon. We're going to get NOAA fixed.
Well, you talk to Elon and tell him I'm willing to help. So
yeah, I totally have a direct line to Elon. Absolutely. No, we'll work on that. So Cliff, we appreciate your time.
It's good to talk to you.
That has been episode 2 in our special series, Truth Tellers. For episode 3, we're going to take you down to Portland, Oregon, and introduce you to a woman named Tara Fowle. Tara Fowle is an independent journalist who has been documenting the decline of Portland, Oregon ever since the riots of 2020. She now spends a lot of time photographing and documenting the homeless and the drug crisis, and she is one of the most important truth tellers on the West Coast. You can watch Truth Tellers for free across all of our platforms, but if you'd like to support our show, you can do that for just $5 a month at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com.